I mean, a poem has to be an event in language, you know.
During his lifetime, and since his death in August 2013, much has been said about Seamus Heaney, the poet and public man.
An event in the language, but also it has to be a representation of the world, you know.
But what of Heaney, the working man? Heaney, the teacher? Heaney, the Oxford professor of poetry?
It is a fact that a great institution with a great history, the university first of all, and then the professorship, does give you a sense of being responsible to something more than yourself.
In 1989, Seamus Heaney became the first Irishman to hold the historic Oxford Chair of Poetry.
Never once in, how long, 5 years, 15 lectures, I never once told a joke, because I felt, with the stereotyping, you know, the minute you do it, you're just another paddy.
His election marked a crucial point in his creative and critical life. And as we shall see, the appointment also revitalised the role itself, raising the bar for future poets elected to the Oxford Chair.
One of the things that we're coming to realise is just what an extraordinary teacher, educator, lecturer and prose writer that he was.
After a difficult period in, whatever you call it, Anglo-Irish relations, to have Seamus amongst us as an unquestionably eminent and outstanding kind of Irish presence was hugely supportive.
It's as if he was at the top of a well of Irish literature, but that well led down to the whole of world literature, and that he could, as it were, let a bucket down into it and pull out through his Irish culture all the cultures of the world, and could hear the echoes of all of that poetry, but through his Irish identity.
Bicycles, college scarves, and academic brilliance. I've come to Oxford University, the privileged alma mater of 26 British prime ministers, 2 English kings, a dozen saints, 32 archbishops of Canterbury, and 1 American president. It's believed that there has been a university here since 1096. And these days, Oxford University is made up of 38 constituent colleges dotted around the city centre, each with its own distinctive personality, each with its own roll call of illustrious graduates. Between former students and academic staff, Oxford University can boast more than 50 Nobel Prize winners, and Seamus Heaney is one of that number. In 1989, just before he took the post, he was a guest on BBC Radio 4's Desert Island Discs, and he told Sue Lawley about his reaction to being elected Oxford Professor of Poetry.
Well, it began to matter more to me after the, so to speak, result was declared. Beforehand, I kept it at a distance within myself. I mean, I took it all very playfully, and in fact, many of the remarks I made inside about 3 minutes of hearing the result were faintly sceptical, but I have to say that it's impossible not to respond to the great arch that stretches back, and not to respond to the sense of occasion in Oxford itself. It is a fact that a great institution with a great history, the university first of all, and then the professorship, does give you a sense of being responsible to something more than yourself.
Really. So what are you now called upon to do? I mean, how do you profess poetry?
Well, the statutory requirement is to give 3 lectures each year, 1 in each term. And I was looking at the original founding statutes, and they are to speak of the old poets in order to polish the endowments of the young, I think, and to help in human and sacred learning.
Seamus Heaney's relationship with the English literary scene was very well established by 1989. He was firmly embedded within the renowned London publishing house Faber & Faber. But that said, his relationship with the British poetry world at the time did result in the odd moment of awkwardness and standoff.
I think both Andrew and I felt he's the great poet of, if not our generation, the generation slightly before ours, and he hadn't yet been promoted in a really popular anthology.
Author and critic Blake Morrison, along with the poet and later poet laureate Andrew Motion, included Seamus in the 1983 Penguin Book of Contemporary British Poetry. Seamus responded by asserting his Irishness in an open letter addressed to the editors. It was a considered and even-handed piece, but one especially quotable couplet was to stand out from all the rest. "My passport's green. No glass of ours was ever raised to toast the Queen."
And I don't think, Andrew may correct me, that we ever thought twice about the title. The Penguin Book of Contemporary British Poetry. British, why not? Seamus had been in anthologies of British writing before, 3-4 times. So yes, I mean, as far as we were concerned, you know, Seamus was a major poet who hadn't yet been given his due, and this anthology was going to give it to him.
He acknowledges himself at the beginning of that yes, he has been in previous anthologies that were termed British. But were you surprised, you know, upset by
not upset
by his
at
reaction?
All. Not upset. And again, Andrew may correct me. I thought he dealt with us, given that it was addressed to Andrew and myself, with great tact and diplomacy and nuance and subtlety and agility, as you'd expect. No reason to be upset. Very interesting that he'd taken up that position, and in a way, a confirmation of what I'd been talking about in that little book about him, that these things did matter to him, Irish, British, you know, what you were called and so on. But he had decided to make a stand. We had provoked him. But the times had changed too, you know, things had got more intense. There was more pressure on him perhaps to say, you know, well, where do you stand, you know, as a Catholic author, are you happy with this British nomenclature? And he wasn't.
In 2012, Seamus did a public interview with Olivia O'Leary.
You've always made a point of describing yourself as an Irish poet. I remember meeting you in Cheltenham in the 70s, where you were cross because you'd been introduced as a British poet. But you wrote a protest poem to Penguin when they included you with other Northern Ireland poets in the Penguin Book of Contemporary British Poetry. But what I wanted to ask you, I mean, I've worked in Britain and I've worked for the BBC, and when the British take you to their hearts, that is very, very seductive. Did you find yourself having to resist that seduction?
No, I never thought of myself resisting it. But I never thought of it as seduction either, to tell you the truth. But you're right. I mean, you probably, I mean, have a lot of friends, genuine friends from that time.
Yeah.
And I equally, since crossing the water in the late 60s into a literary milieu, I made a lot of very good friends, were still very good friends. In fact, the two guys who edited the Book of Contemporary British Poetry were good friends and are good friends still. But I would have to say that I enjoyed the the welcome, you know.
Andrew, I mean, Blake clearly took no offence, and it was a carefully constructed letter, but again, it had a real firmness about it that surprised people, maybe.
Sure. I was a bit upset that he was upset. I didn't feel insulted. I think that was the word you used. I absolutely didn't feel insulted. But because I respected him so much and was beginning to like him, though I hardly knew him in those days, certainly very much less well than I came to know him, for all those reasons, I was sorry that I'd upset him. So in those sense, I do regret it. However, I think it's very difficult to estimate now, this far after the event, how much less notice was still being taken, generally speaking, during that time, of these kinds of discriminations that lie behind Seamus's argument in that poem and in his saying what he did say. I don't say this to kind of let ourselves off a hook of some description or another, and I don't say it to undo all that I've just said, but I think it is worth emphasising how much more prepared many people, including the other poets from Northern Ireland in that anthology, for instance, and Seamus himself on the evidence of his having previously been willing to appear in books with that title. How much more willing in those days people were to let that go than they are now. In fact, I so strongly feel that I've kind of brought myself to the position of thinking that one of the good things that our anthology did was to provide the occasion to crystallise that, certainly in him. Well, it manifestly did crystallise it in him. And if that had a good effect, which I think we can say that it did through the poems in vast and complicated ways, then we did something good.
I have here a letter that Seamus wrote in March 1983. I was working for the Observer at that time, and I'd obviously asked him to write a book review, and the beginning of this letter is, you'll see, mentions that. But what he's chiefly doing is explaining to me that he's writing some sort of poem about the fact that Andrew and I included him in the Penguin Book of Contemporary British Poetry, and he's just gently getting me used to the idea that there's this poem. Indeed, he encloses a copy, an early draft of the poem. He says, "I have to apologise again for not delivering Neruda. But in the meantime, I enclose copies of the lines in response to the nomenclature." Nomenclature, however you say it. "It is, of course, a kind of public gesture, but it springs from a genuine sense of crisis about the whole thing. I've a reluctance to raise the subject, but a sense of abdication if I leave it alone. The exercise is finally purgative for me and may prove a salutary irritant all round. At the same time, I don't want it to be a sectarian anti-Brit tract. So I'm relying on tone and our friendship to carry the day." He adds, "I'd be grateful if you kept it close to your chest for a few weeks. Between ourselves, it may come out as a pamphlet."
Brilliant. Brilliant.
Now the time is coming up to 17 minutes to 9. A new professor of poetry will be chosen by a vote of graduates on the 3rd of next month in Oxford. The post is 280 years in existence and becomes available every 5 years. It carries a salary of just over £3,000, and previous holders of this office have included W.H. Auden, Robert Graves, and Roy Fuller. This year, there are three candidates: the poet C.H. Sisson, who is 75 years old and is a retired civil servant; the Rastafarian poet, Benjamin Zephaniah; and our own Seamus Heaney, who has declined nomination on two previous occasions. But his backers now include the current incumbent, Peter Levy, and the literary critic and lecturer, Bernard O'Donoghue, who is on the phone now from Oxford. Good morning, Bernard.
Good morning, David.
Why should Seamus Heaney become professor of poetry this year?
Well, I mean, I think that as far as Oxford is concerned, it's a matter of any year, really, because he's recognised as one of the leading English language poets in the world, so Oxford always wants to have him. And if he's willing, that's great.
So, what are the chances for Seamus Heaney? Do you think he's going to, is it going to be a walk-in?
Well, I don't think it'll be a walk-in, but I think he should win. I mean, I think if people do the right thing, he will win, because he is very much the most distinguished of the field, and, you know, the most distinguished person available these days, and has been regarded as that for the past 10 years, really, when people have been pleading with him to stand.
Well, we'll see what happens on June 3rd. Bernard, thank you very much indeed for taking our call. That was the literary critic and lecturer, Bernard O'Donoghue, on the line there from Oxford. The time now is coming up to 13 minutes to 9.
And we move on now to perhaps some other opportunities for Irish young people. Young people.
Okay, it seems you're
Magdalen Bridge Boathouse in Oxford. Tourists and students indulge in that most Oxonian of traditions, punting. It's all rather Brideshead, and a long way from rural County Derry, where the Moyola runs through Castle Dawson on its journey to Loch Ness.
I don't know that I'd say anything necessarily had changed. I think that the moment when he wrote an open letter was a very particular moment in Irish history, but also in British history.
Geraldine Higgins was a graduate student in Oxford during Seamus's time as professor of poetry. Born and raised in Ballymena, she's now director of Irish studies at Emory University in Atlanta and curator of that university's Seamus Heaney collection and exhibition.
we have a letter where he's writing to Ted Hughes and he's saying, you know, I feel very uncomfortable about my inclusion in this anthology, but they're my friends. I don't really want to cause a huge fuss, but neither do I want to be part of this kind of British Falklandia triumphalism. And so I think that, you know, in some ways people tend to focus on Heaney's reluctance to take a stand, but I actually think he agonised over every decision and every single time that he does come out and take a stance on the North or on his Irishness or on the relationship with Britain. It's extremely well thought out. It's agonised over, and it's not that it had changed, but that he didn't see it as a political thing. He saw this as a poetry thing. I mean, I don't know. I often think if there was one line of his poetry that he would unwrite if he could, it might be "Whatever you say, say nothing," because that's the line that's used, I think, by journalists to say, oh, that's him saying, you know, toe the line, keep your head down, don't rock the boat. You know, that it seems like that's him kind of cozying up to the establishment. But I don't know, as somebody from there, I think it doesn't mean that at all. I think it's all about you do keep your head down for survival. You know, you don't go out and pick the battles. You don't meet the trouble halfway down the road, but you're able to figure out, you know, you figure out what you want to say and you say it.
Religion's never mentioned here, of course. You know them by their eyes and hold your tongue. One side's as bad as the other, never worse. Christ, it's near time that some small leak was sprung in the great dikes the Dutchman made, Dutchman being William of Orange, the great dikes the Dutchman made to dam the dangerous tide that followed Seamus, King James. Yet for all thy art and sedentary trade, I am incapable. The famous northern reticence, the tight gag of place and times, yes, yes. Of the wee six I sing, where to be saved, you only must save face, and whatever you say nothing. Smoke signals are loud-mouthed compared with us. Maneuverings to find out name and school, subtle discrimination by addresses, with hardly an exception to the rule that Norman, Ken and Sydney signal prod, and Seamus, call me Sean, our surefire pip. O land of password, hand grip, wink and nod, of open minds as open as a trap, where tongues lie coiled as under flames lie wicks, where half of us, as in a wooden horse, were cabined and confined like wily Greeks, besieged within the siege, whispering Morse.
The university always aspires, you know, to get the best person, the current sort of leader.
We heard him earlier speaking to David Hanley. The Oxford academic and critic Bernard O'Donoghue was a prominent supporter of Heaney's in the 1989 election.
Everybody would have agreed by the late 80s, by 1988, when this canvassing was being done, that Seamus Heaney was number one that people wanted.
It's interesting to remember that in those days, before the Nobel, etc., he was already a sort of a superstar.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think the Nobel was only a confirmation of what everybody had known, really. I mean, you know, by 1988, the year before was the Hall Lantern with clearances in it, you know, and there was Station Island and fieldwork, you know, going backwards. I mean, they're huge, huge volumes, you know. For each of those different people who claimed that it was one of the great books of the 20th century, you know. So he was a very, very major figure by then. What I do, what I'm very aware of is that, you know, I, as Irish, you know, and, you know, there's some degree of foreignness always, you know. It was a huge fillip to have Seamus Heaney here, you know. And at a difficult time as well, you know, at the end of the 1980s, when maybe the clouds were just starting to lift a bit. But after a difficult period in, Anglo-Irish relations, to have... to have Seamus, you know, amongst us as an unquestionably eminent and outstanding kind of Irish presence was hugely supportive. And of course, when Seamus appeared in the streets or came furtively to the pubs, whatever he did, there was a huge thrill to it all for the Irish community.
I mean, he was a celebrity here, wasn't he?
Absolutely. That's the only word for it, really. Yeah.
It felt just so exciting.
Geraldine Higgins again.
You felt so privileged to be there, you know, and, you know, it wasn't always, when I was at Oxford, it wasn't always cool to be Irish. It was a difficult time to be Irish in England. And suddenly Seamus Heaney's presence there, I suppose, coalesced a sense of, you know, there was a really great group of Irish students there. We were known as the Murphia. And, you know, we would pour into the pub after the lectures, and Heaney would be there and he would just be chatting to everybody. You know, and there were those great scholars, John Kelly, Bernard O'Donoghue, were at the centre of, you know, Irish intellectual life in Oxford. And then later Roy Foster also became the history professor. But it really sort of brought everybody together in a way that just hadn't been there. It hadn't been there before.
Your time at Oxford, when you were professor of poetry, and there was a certain element even down here of, you know, Catholic boy is, Catholic nationalist boy is professor of poetry at Oxford. Did you feel at home there, as at home as you perhaps were to feel later on in Harvard?
The thing that I did in Oxford to avoid a kind of ethnic chic. I never once in, how long, 5 years, 15 lectures, I never once told a joke.
Or sang a song.
Or made the audience laugh. Because I felt, with the stereotyping, you know, the minute you do it, you're just another Paddy, you know? So, I mean, that was a very deliberate decision.
Heck.
Early evening in the cloister, or the great quad of Magdalen College. The famous choir rehearses. The bells of the great tower ring out. In the great hall, the bust of the college's most notable convict, Oscar Wilde, sits opposite the bust of the college's most notable judge, Lord Denning, an arrangement Seamus would certainly have appreciated. After all, it was Seamus, after winning the Nobel, who bought the bust of Wilde for Magdalen.
One of my great joys recently was to be made a fellow of Magdalen College, a supernumerary, non-stipendiary fellow, nevertheless fellow.
And is that what they called it?
Yes, it is.
Makes you sound like a magistrate. Yeah.
Well, and one of the joys of being at Magdalen is to go to listen to the choir in the chapel.
I remember all the first morning, which I think was a Saturday morning.
The broadcaster and author Anthony Smith was president of Magdalen when Seamus was made a fellow and elected professor of poetry.
And I was talking to a student in my office when, at about midday, I heard the steps of the bard descending the stairs. And I, that very moment, we heard a scuffling in the chimney. And the student and I went to look at what was this strange noise, and it was a bird that had fallen down the chimney. And we didn't know quite what to do about it. And it was at that moment I heard the footsteps of Seamus. So I ran out and said, "Seamus, Seamus, we've got a bird stuck in the chimney. You're a nature poet. Tell us what to do." And he said, "Oh, I know I'm a nature poet, but I never touch the stuff." And came into the room, and with his wonderful sort of countryman's hands, he found the foot of the bird, grasped it, and very gently but firmly brought it out of the chimney into the room. And I opened the window, and the bird flew away, and it was a white dove.
You see, you couldn't make that up.
No.
And this was day one in Oxford.
That was day one, yes.
How do you think Seamus felt about being in Oxford?
I don't think he was at all daunted by it. He had a special way of being an Irish poet. It seemed to me, and I've thought of hard about how to describe this, it's as if he was at the top of a well of Irish literature and Irishness of all kinds. But that well led down to the whole of world literature, and that he could, as it were, let a bucket down into it and pull out through his Irish culture all the cultures of the world. And it's no accident that his great friend was Brodsky. He knew a lot of Polish and Russian poetry. He was at home in the world of poetry and could hear the echoes of all of that poetry, but through his Irish identity.
Did Seamus write anything about Oxford?
He did. One of the things about Oxford and Magdalen College in particular is that it's full of ceremonies. And Seamus, I tried to get him into all of them because I was hoping to get the Magdalen poem out of him without actually asking for it, because that was, would certainly, I knew not to be the way to get it. So I made certain that he climbed up the tower on May morning and participated in all of these. And in fact, in his book, Electric Light, there is a Magdalen poem. And it's all about the deer and lots of references to the topography of the college in it. But that's as near as he got to a Magdalen poem.
The colour of meadow hay, with its meadow sweet and liver spotted dock leaves. There they were before we noticed them, all eyes and evening, up to their necks in the meadow. Where? I still can't. There. Oh, yes. Of course, yes. Lovely. And they didn't move away. There, like the air agog, the step of light on grass, halted mid-light, heartbeat and pupil. A match for us, and watching.
But there's more to Oxford than deer parks, towers, and gracious dining rooms. On Corn Market Street, you could be in any small English city. Shoppers, chain stores, and buskers. All the signs that this place has a life beyond its reputation as a world centre of learning.
I mean, Oxford as a town, if you think about it economically, is sort of post-industrial, built around the car plant down the end of the Cowley Road, which has had gone through difficult times, so many people laid off. So that, if you like, is a kind of real-world Oxford separate from the university.
Dubliner John Redmond is a poet and critic based at the University of Liverpool. But in the early 1990s, he was a graduate student at Oxford, while Seamus Heaney was professor of poetry.
So there are town pubs and there are gown pubs. There are pubs that you go into and you behave like a student. You can expect a tough time. And students don't even bother going into them because they know that. There's that element. There's a town and gown, but there's a third element, are the tourists coming through. And the tourists are often treated somewhat roughly by people, both the students and the town people. So Oxford is a strange place in terms of antagonism, that there are these different groups who really don't like each other very much or have very little to do with each other, rubbing up against each other in a small space. It's tight, cramped, confined, Oxford in many ways, not a big place. And so you get a lot of argy-bargy and kind of... you have to be a little bit tough, I think, when you're in Oxford in a way. Like, coming out at clubs and pubs at night, it's often quite aggressive. People never kind of believe this if you kind of tell them, because I think they have a different image of Oxford in their heads. But on the ground, if you're actually here, you really do have to just watch out what you're doing, especially, you know, after 11 o'clock.
How would Seamus then have fitted into this world of Oxford? Where did he stay in one particular corner of it?
Yeah, I think for him being here, I think he would have found many strange vibrations in the place. The place sends out lots of peculiar signals, especially the longer you're here. I think at first you're aware of the kind of picture book Oxford, and you kind of, it conforms to your image that it has in one's head. After being here for a while, though, you see other sides to it, which are less rosy. It's quite a cold place, basically. So it's an emotionally cold place. People are often distant or hostile. For me, the best thing about being in Oxford was the people I met, Heaney being one of those people. And that's true all the time. You can meet fantastic people. But for the rest of it, a lot of it is quite negative. So it's a weird balance, and people often leave here with very mixed feelings.
The way you describe Oxford, it sounds like the last place Seamus Heaney ought to be, because, you know, I mean, a place that's cold and isn't friendly and is narrow and all that. That's not what he was about at all.
No, and I think I think there was an uneasiness sometimes when he was here. I think you could see that. Now, Heaney always brought around his own kind of special halo of personal warmth, and he could bathe anyone in that or any scene in that, and he did. So I'm not saying like that kind of coldness necessarily terribly much affected him. But yeah, Heaney was very sensitive to environments, and he did pick up on a lot of things. And we did bring him out to places that were, I suppose, quite rough, essentially, like down the Cowley Road, the Bullingdon Arms. That was one of the places we brought him for a kind of meeting of graduate students who were reading out their own poems. Brought him out to a kind of rough back room. He sat around. He got a bit of pneumonia, I think, out of it. And some of his party, he brought John Kelly and his wife, I think, that time. And so, like, you know, someone who's about to win the Nobel Prize is in this horrible back room of, effectively a dive, and listening to students read out their poems. He's extremely indulgent, you know. He definitely didn't have to do that. And lots of people in his position never would think of doing that.
I think, for example, of a sound. I use this sometimes when I'm teaching about poetry, that there is a line which runs across Britain and Ireland, and north of it, people say, "Ugh," and south of it, they say, "Oh dear." And I think you'd say that somehow poetry taps the "ughness" of your nature, or the "oh dearness," that there is a reservoir somewhere where a certain melody, a certain rhythm, a certain syllable, a certain touch wakens and opens a space into your whole affective, your whole emotional nature. And the most satisfying experiences of poetry are where that inner touch is felt, it's felt instinctively. You don't say, "There, I have been touched inwardly, thank goodness for that," but something happens. There's an excitement and a pacification at once.
Not all my pupils, but a small group of Irish postgraduates used to meet at a rather dilapidated but very good pub called the Bullingdon Arms.
Professor John Kelly taught in the university's English department and, along with Bernard O'Donoghue, was instrumental in Seamus's election as Professor of Poetry in 1989.
So we went up the Cowley Road through the sleet and rain and whatnot and into the... And there they all were in the Bullingdon. I got the hot whiskies all round, and he listened patiently to these young people reading their stuff, some good, some perhaps not quite so good. And what I thought was remarkable about it at the end of the day, he found he never praised anything that wasn't good, but he always found something that was good without patronising, without bluffing, without lying. He had this, I mean, one of his great poems, The Diviner, is almost image of the poet. How do you know it's there? Suddenly it shakes. And somehow it was like a critical divining that he just found good stuff, positive stuff to say and correct things, no sense of talking down, but he never praised anything that didn't deserve it. I thought it was an exemplary afternoon.
Divining is a very entrancing kind of activity. Scientifically, it doesn't exist. The Encyclopedia Britannica says there's absolutely no basis for any trust in this activity. However, it has a saving last sentence where it says this method seems to be as successful as any other. The diviner cut from the green hedge a forked hazel stick that he held tight by the arms of the V, circling the terrain, hunting the pluck of water, nervous but professionally unfussed. The pluck came sharp as a sting. The rod jerked with precise convulsions, spring water suddenly broadcasting through a green hazel its secret stations. The bystanders would ask to have a try. He handed them the rod without a word. It lay dead in their grasp, till, nonchalantly, he gripped expectant wrists. The hazel stirred. And if one were a good enough writer and we were all good enough listeners, the whole poem could be reduced to one word, one syllable, stirred, which happily rhymes with word.
John, this was 1989. It was a year of significant early statements from Sinn Féin and from the British on what could possibly lie ahead. But that said, the killing was continuing on all sides. Indeed, some of the most high-profile incidents of the entire period happened in 1989. Now, this was the year Seamus took up this post in Oxford. Inevitably, all these events must have exercised him greatly.
They did. I mean, you couldn't be impervious to it, and especially since he found in himself the division in a way. I mean, he was a nationalist, but a constitutional nationalist, and so horrified by violence on both sides. So, I mean, he was very conscious of the division in himself. Before he was professor of poetry, I went to a huge poetry reading he gave. But it was just when the first of the hunger strikers was dying, and actually I think died just that day. And it was someone from Derry and someone who he'd sort of vaguely not well known it. And after this triumphal poetry reading, he went off to All Souls, which is the most establishment college in Oxford, and was sort of wined and dined there. And I met him for coffee the next day, and he was full of the contradictions and conscience, really, about being, as it were, in this establishment situation while things were going so badly in the north. And he was angry. I mean, there's no doubt that he was personally deeply anguished by that, as of course, why wouldn't he be? But it was a deep and genuine anguish. And the temptation then to blurt something out, to write in a kind of response of immediate anger, must have been almost irresistible. But I think rightly resisted it, because when you write under that kind of pressure, when it is such a complex field of emotions, you're almost certainly going to come out with something which is pushed by the events, not by the response to the events in all its complexity.
Both Graves and Auden as professors of poetry.
The poet John Stalworthy was a valued friend and a colleague in Oxford's English department.
And the lectures weren't nearly as good as Seamus's. It was a 5-year stint of 3 lectures, that's 15 major lectures, is more than almost all poets have in them, and more than most professors have in them. And by the time Auden and Graves got about to lectures 10, 11, 12, they were really falling apart. They were chatting about another trip round Edward Thomas country or something. Whereas Seamus was thinking them through, writing them out, and he often would come in waving them because it was still wet, his lectures. But they were real lectures right to the end.
Tell me a little bit, John, about how Seamus conducted himself in Oxford, you know, socially, in dealing with this world.
very charming, very relaxed. My recollection is that he was more often in sort of grey flannel bags and a tweed jacket than in suits. I'm sure he wore a suit from time to time, but he didn't do the formal thing. I mean, if it was necessary, he would certainly do it, because the last thing he would have wanted to do was to get out of step or call attention to himself inappropriately. I think what people loved and respected was his easiness with people, and he was wonderful in that he was available to everyone. And one thing you noticed was that when he would be talking, say, to an undergraduate, some shy little person, and the vice-chancellor would come up behind, Seamus would continue to talk to them. He wouldn't look at the vice-chancellor. He just went on talking to that person. He, to whomever he was talking, that was the person he was interested in. He wasn't looking over his shoulder for a greater or better person at all. And he was the same to them all. I mean, he would answer the question, the stupid question from the student, or maybe the stupid question from the vice-chancellor, graciously and... but in exactly the same voice.
Dawn on May morning outside Magdalen College, and I'm taking part in a very ancient Oxford tradition when crowds cram High Street to hear the Magdalen Choir herald the changing of the seasons from the top of the Great Tower. The throng, Morris dancers betraying the pagan origins of the ritual, tourists enjoying the pageantry, and of course some very bleary-eyed students who have been up all night doing what students do. Some are in tuxes, some are in ball gowns, some have flowers in their hair. All are gathered to welcome the May, to be revived by the music and the ancient bells of Oxford ringing out across the city.
I don't mind people reading things out of the poems, but there is a difference between reading things into them. If somebody comes with prepared notions and rips evidence for it out of the things, that's one thing. But I think it is entirely possible to dwell upon a poem, to dwell upon a rhythm or a word or a run of words, and to extend and draw out meanings that the poet wasn't entirely conscious of. The analogy I sometimes use is of action replay in television football. If you see a goal being scored first in action, it's very speedy, straight it goes. It's a whole sudden instinctive combination of chance and intention. Then you stop the thing, you go back and say, play it back, look at that, look at this move. The guys didn't know quite what they were doing when they were doing it, but the commentator and the experts watching the action replay can show you what's happening.
I think in some ways, since Heaney's death, everyone's returning to the poetry and, thinking again about what it means and what it will continue to mean in the future. But I also think one of the things that we're coming to realise is just what an extraordinary teacher, educator, lecturer, and prose writer that he was, and just the extraordinary sense of emotion and care that he took over every single word, and the way he would read poetry is just something that I think is one of his greatest legacies. It was one of the earlier lectures, and Seamus forgot a couple of lines. He was quoting one of his own poems and he forgot a couple of lines, and Mary spoke up from the audience and filled in the lines, and we were obsessed by that moment and just what it said about their closeness and her engagement with with knowing, oh, he was meant to say this, and he, you know, filling it in for him. And I've often thought about that and thought about that sense of influence. And I suppose curating the exhibition, one of the things I noticed in the correspondence and just looking at this amazing correspondence was what a male world he really lived in. Like all the major correspondents are male, people like Ted Hughes and Paul Muldoon and, hundreds of other people. But I realised then that really at the centre of it, though, is Mary, is this incredible marriage, and that there is this sense of, I suppose, the way in which Heaney was a solitary figure but so connected and so engaged with everybody that there is. So I suppose the legacy is also about that, about, you know, how, you know, the pursuit of an academic life isn't a solitary thing. It's all about engaging with other people and keeping that those relationships alive. You know, that it wasn't just one person in that room, it was both of them.
Wide-ranging 1995 interview, just after being awarded the Nobel Prize, Seamus spoke to Mike Murphy on The Art Show.
The critical prose that I have written, I never enjoyed the idea of doing it, you know? I was always anxious, but in the end I enjoyed the clarification of having done it. The prose, on the whole, over the years, I think, has been instrumental in helping me to think about poetry and clarify my head about it.
I think in any writer, the balance between the chance to commune with yourself, explore things about yourself,
and emotion again,
extend the range of your understanding of writers that you love, extend the range of writers in general, discover new writers that you didn't realise that you liked so much, always needs to be balanced by practicalities that are thrown up by those inquiries, particularly the question of time and how it eats into your time writing about these things. There's that. And then there's also the question of whether, as you articulate your feelings about these people and about your own practice, you also overexpose something in yourself, which then makes the writing of poems damagingly self-knowing. But I think it's fair to say that Seamus seems to have handled those two difficulties, though they are real difficulties, very well, because you don't see a sort of catastrophic falling off in the work after the lectures have been written. You see an attempt to take the work in slightly different directions, though that, who knows what else that might be to do with, as well as being a professor of poetry. But on the whole, I think that it adds a kind of slightly deeper note to a lot of the things that he was writing about. It doesn't seem to do him any harm. And in other respects, I mean, one could go on almost indefinitely about this, but at least one other thing that's probably worth saying is that in his deportment, in the way that he carried himself as a poet, he did a quite immense amount of good for poetry. To be a great poet and to behave like that, that's rare. And he pulled it off, pulled off that balance, managed to hold that balance with a really remarkable grace, I think. And so it's not surprising in those terms that we find people grieving for him in the way that they do. He had an extraordinary ability as a poet on the page and as a poet going about his own poetic business to make his readers and the people who came into contact with him feel that it was in some very particular way for them.
I want to ask you now to read a poem, and it was a lovely poem that you wrote for a new niece who is half English.
Yes. This poem was written quickly because it was called for quickly. We had arrived at Murray's sister's house in Gloucestershire, and we'd forgotten that there was a new baby in the house who had just been christened, and there was no present. We had no present to give the kid. So we went out to discuss it. And it was a very beautiful house called Bradley Court with long walks and lawns and so on. And there, as we walked along, I found a peacock's feather. And Mary said, give them that. And write a poem about it. So I did write the poem, actually, between getting it and going down to dinner. That's the virtue of a good rhyme scheme. It speeds you along. Anyway, it's called A Peacock's Feather, and it's written in 1972. And it's, all the trouble is there, and there is England and a beautiful landscape. Anyway, A Peacock's Feather for Daisy Garnett. 6 days ago the water fell to christen you, to work its spell and wipe your slate, we hope, for good. But now your life is sleep and food, which with a touch of love suffice you, Daisy, Daisy, English niece, Gloucestershire. Its prospects lie wooded and misty to my eye, whose landscape, as your mother's was, is other than this mellowness of topiary lawn and brick, possessed, untrespassed, walled, nostalgic. I come from scraggy farm and moss, old patchworks that the pitch and toss of history have left dishevelled. But here, for your sake, I have levelled my cart track voice to garden tones, cobbled the bog with Cotswold stones, ravelling strands of family's mesh in love knots of two minds, one flesh. The future's not our own. We'll weave an in-law maze. We'll nod and wave with trust, but little intimacy. So this is a billet-doux to say that in a warm July you lay christened and smiling in Bradley, while I, a guest in your green court, at a west window sat and wrote self-consciously in gathering dark, I might as well be in Cool Park. So before I leave your ordered home, let us pray. May tilth and loam, darkened with Celts and Saxons' blood, breastfeed your love of house and wood. Where I drop this for you as I pass, like the peacock's feather on the grass.
Living in Oxford, spending time in Harvard, so you're Britain, the United States, has it given you a different perspective on Ireland?
I don't think it has changed my perception of Ireland all that much. I don't know how to answer that. I mean, your experience of growing up and growing older is simply of still being yourself somehow, you know, but knowing a little bit more. I think of it as the ripple that's moving out, you know. The ripple begins very, very small and it extends and extends and extends. It's still the same ripple, but it has more within itself, as it were, other ripples.